Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to look at what happens in the gut of a baby when it's being breastfed. Love makes you strong. Romantic relationships help neurotic people stabilize their personality. Eating red pepper helps curb your appetite. I'm talking about sweet pepper also. And is your depression caused by inflammatory foods? That's an important one. 5 diseases proven to respond better to cannabis than prescription drugs, and a lot more on health and nutrition. Then we're going to look at several issues. When water is a commodity instead of a human right. Pete Dolek of Counterpunch. This is particularly important because of what's happening in Detroit, where the residents are being told that we're going to turn off your water, and indeed 150,000 people have had their water turned off. Now think of that. That's what a homeless person faces each day. When they wake up, they have no place to shower, brush their teeth, go to the bathroom. The average person takes a lot of this stuff for granted until you no longer have water. Well, why isn't this a human right? Also, we're going to look at the shocking facts about America's militarized police forces. Alex Kane of Alternet. The military occupation of Ferguson. It is my belief that within the next 5 years, we will have 100 Fergusons, except it won't be a small little area like Ferguson in Missouri. We're going to see the tipping of those who are so poor that when they respond, they will be absolutely destroyed by the militarized police forces in place. I'm going to do a commentary on that today. Also today, a commentary by Dan Glazebrook from Middle East Eye. Israel's target is not Hamas, but Palestinian statehood. This is a different perspective that I believe deserves an opportunity, since virtually 99.99% of all major media has focused upon the talking points put out by AIPAC and the enormous amount of supporters of the Likud and the Zionist people in power, rather than the truth. And by the way, there's an enormous peace movement and truth movement on behalf of Orthodox Jews and progressives and Jews. We're not hearing about it. We're not hearing them speak out because the media is not covering them. Colgate, their toothpaste, Total, contains a chemical that's linked to cancer. So you see, we have a lot. Plus, no guest today. If time permits, I'm going to play you a posting that I put on our website early this morning. It's about a black woman smiling. It is extremely powerful. One of the most poetic, insightful, and astute commentaries I've ever heard. It's about 5 minutes long. It'll either be played today or on our next program. We're also going to be starting a three half-hour parts of a documentary produced, narrated by Bill Moyers, and this was done in 1987. Everything he was talking about then and showing is exactly happening today. I thought it was appropriate, so we're going to play it, because I don't think very many people have seen it. Let's begin. We know from hundreds of studies that breastfeeding is much better than formula feeding. And there's always another reason. Today, this comes from the Technical University of Denmark, and they found that the nutritional factor that has the greatest impact on the development of a child's gut flora is whether the child is breastfed. This is according to the National Food Institute, Technical University of Denmark. And the study shows that breastfeeding promotes the good bacteria of lactic acid bacteria in the baby's gut flora. And that's going to help the child's immune system develop normally. Now, there are at least 200 studies in the peer-reviewed literature showing that breastfed babies grow at a different rate and are trimmer than children who are fed infant formula. They also have less obesity, less allergies, less diabetes, including type 1 diabetes, and less inflammatory bowel disease later in life. And according to this study, this is due to the fact that breastfeeding promotes the development of beneficial bacteria in the baby's gut. Quote, "We have become increasingly aware of how crucially important a healthy gut microbial population is for a well-functioning immune system. Babies are born without bacteria in the gut, and so it is interesting to identify the influence dietary factors have on gut microbiota development in children's first 3 years of life," end quote. So wherever possible, breastfeeding. But then again, the breastfeeding has to be done in a way where the mother's health is also essential. For example, I counsel pregnant women all the time. I counsel women who want to become pregnant, and they've heard the program, and they heard me many times say, and I'll say it again, I do not recommend any woman have a planned pregnancy until they've gone through a 2-year detoxification and rejuvenation. Why? Because the silver fillings, the mercury fillings in your mouth, and by the way, every one of those silver fillings is not actual silver, it's mercury. And because when mercury oxidizes, it looks like silver. And that is going into the blood and will go into the breast milk. That's bad. Also, if you have heavy metals, lead, cadmium, mercury, that, from even vaccines you've received, that'll go right into the placenta into the developing fetus. In fact, they didn't find a lot of mercury in the pregnant woman. When they did an analysis, they found it in the placenta. The epigenetics, anything that was of a emotional trauma earlier in life to the mother, should be processed so it's no longer going to contribute to the epigenetics, which it would of the developing fetus. So, and also building up the mother's maternal nutrition so she's optimally well. And that's important. I'll be doing a documentary on this in the next year. Love makes you strong. Romantic relationships helps neurotic people stabilize their personality. This is from Frederick Schiller University in Jena. Quote, "Newly enamored couples walking through the city hand in hand, floating on cloud nine. Yet a few weeks later, the initial rush of romance will be dissolved and the world will not appear as rosy anymore. Nevertheless, love and romance have long-lasting effects." Psychologists of the German University of Jena and Kassel discovered that a romantic relationship can have a positive effect on personality development in young adults. Research report on this finding in the science magazine Journal of Personality. The scientists focused on neuroticism, one of the five characteristics considered to be the basic dimensions of human personality, which can be used to characterize every human being. Quote, "Neurotic people are rather anxious, insecure, and easily annoyed. They have a tendency towards depression, often show low self-esteem, and tend to generally be dissatisfied with their lives. However, we were able to show that they become more stable in a love relationship, and their personality stabilizes." And the scientists found that this tendency gradually decreases over time when a romantic relationship is in bloom. On the other hand, the partners support each other, and the positive experiences, quote, "of emotions gained by having a partner change personality, not directly but indirectly, as at the same time the thought structures and the perceptions of presumably negative situations change." To put it more simply, love helps us tackle life with more confidence instead of seeing things pessimistically all the time. And I might mention this as well. This is my own experience. There are a lot of people, probably the majority of the people, who are not in loving relationships. They're maybe in a relationship, but doesn't mean that it's loving. I just counseled someone who is in a crisis this morning, even though I'm on the road, who is in a family dynamic. It's not loving and is really destructive to the person. But also there are, I believe, opportunities for people now and in the future in small home environments, homesteads, shared living quarters, eco villages, sustainable living villages. There are thousands of these around the world. You never hear about them because they're generally very quiet. They don't stand out. You have to go find them. And then you find that more often than not, these are inhabited, probably 80% of the people, from my experience. They're inhabited by people who were neurotic, were people didn't fit in. They had low self-esteem. But being in an environment, a positive influence, can, if you choose, help you feel the love of other people, the love of nature, the love of animals, and hence change your disposition. I'll give you an example of this. There is a community, I don't know if it's still in existence, but when I was there, it was rather remarkable. There are, I'm going to guess, 20 people living in this community. It was out in Arizona, just south of Flagstaff, and it had an organic garden, a little place in the river where they swam. They were always doing yoga and meditation. They came from all around the United States, and they had shared responsibilities. Some people did the cooking, some did the gardening, some did the maintenance and fixing things, but everyone participated at some level. When I spoke with the people, I found that there was a sense of ease. They were really laid back. They were living in balance. They were happy. And when I asked one of the individuals, what do you feel happy about? And this fellow said, look, he said, I'm 35 years old. I've had three not good relationships. I don't come from a good family background. And I was always depressed or always anxious. Very introverted. I was very shy. And he said, I heard about this place and I came here. And I was fearful that somehow they would not want me because of, you know, my quietness but I fit right in. And he said, I just feel when we're sitting around and we're having a meal together and when someone's reading and someone's playing the guitar, so I just feel so connected. I feel love. And hence, I don't have my anxiety. I don't bite my fingernails down till they bleed. I don't spend days alone. He said, I never knew this life existed. I talked with each and every person there that day, all day, 12, 13 hours I spoke with people. And that's what pretty much the feedback I got. So underneath all the radar in America are a lot of people looking for love, looking for somewhere they can trust themselves, to trust other people, to believe in something other than negative circumstances. Now, because I travel so much, and because I'm always curious to find out firsthand rather than trusting someone else's interpretation of what exists, I like to go see for myself. And I see this phenomena everywhere I go. If you go to Ireland, Spain, Italy, France, you'll see it. All across America, you'll see it. And I believe it's going to grow tremendously. And I'm going to help that movement. I'm going to start writing up and photographing or videoing some of the different communities I go to. Some are tiny, you know, five people. 3 people. Some are larger, 100 people, 200 people. But I'm going to film them. I'm going to post them. At least you'll know that there are other souls out there who are kind, thoughtful, spiritual, giving, nurturing, and sharing people. And maybe for those who are hard-driven and motivated each day by a race. A gun goes off and you get up and you start your day and you have to-do list upon to-do list and you're always barking or being barked at and you're always overstriving and you feel that somehow if you don't stay late and do all that you're supposed to and if you're not responsible for everyone, that there will be a negative consequence. And that's most people. And you isolate yourself from everything in life because you just don't have time or energy for it. So it's time to reconnect with what's going on in the world. Slow down. Exhale. There is another reality. Eating red pepper helps curb the appetite. This is a study done at Purdue University. And it says that when you eat red peppers, you can curb your appetite. Quote, we found that consuming red pepper can help manage appetite and burn more calories after a meal, especially for individuals who do not consume the spice regularly. This finding should be considered a piece of the puzzle because the idea that one small change reverses the obesity epidemic is simply not true. However, if a number of small changes are added together, they may be meaningful in terms of weight management. Okay. Well, there are active ingredients in red peppers. Cayenne pepper is a chili pepper, and it's among the most commonly consumed spices in the world. And in that chili pepper, you have a chemical called capsaicin, C-A-P, capsaicin, C-I-N, capsaicin. And that can change your biochemistry. And what it does is the red pepper consumption increases the core body temperature, and that causes more calories to be burned even when you're sleeping. So that's good. Now add on exercising each day. Add on drinking a lot of water during the day or fresh organic juices. Add on eating light meals or what I call grazing. Just when you're hungry, have something to eat, but something that's living, preferably something raw. Have an apple, peach, pear, plum. Have a cucumber. Have something that you can eat, and therefore you have some satiety. When you have your smoothie in the morning, you're getting all your complex carbohydrates, proteins, fiber, essential fatty acids, antioxidants, polyphenols, chlorophyll, and that's going to sustain you for at least 4 hours. And then have your main meal in the early afternoon and a small meal in the evening, and it's stopping all the unhealthy snacking throughout the day that will cause about 30 pounds weight loss per year in and of itself. So you see, this person's right when they say each thing is a piece of the puzzle. Is your depression caused by inflammatory foods? Long ago, must have been 20 years ago, I wrote a book on the food-mood connection. Then I updated it about, I think, 7 years ago. I did it as a special that was on PBS stations. Now, from the peer-reviewed journal Inflammation, Glutamate, and Glia in Depression, a literature review, what we see is that inflammatory foods do create excitotoxins, and that disrupts your neuroendocrine system, and that triggers depression. So before you treat yourself with a harmful, toxic, worthless, garbage, destructive, should never have been used in American society drugs, look for excitotoxins in your diet. Look for aspartame. Look for MSG. Even look for caffeine. They're all culprits behind the symptoms of depression. How do I know this? Why can I speak with some authority on this instead of just guessing? Because I've done 40 clinical studies. And each of these clinical studies have been done under the strictest conditions. The latest is being published in their journal, and I'm one of the keynote speakers in December at a World Congress on Anti-Aging Medicine because of what the results were, independently confirmed. And I did a study group 9 years ago on depression. To get into the study, you had to have a letter from your physician or psychologist or psychiatrist that you were clinically depressed on medications. There were no medicines given because there are no medical procedures in any of these 40 clinical studies with over 30,000 people total. Instead, it's about behavior modification and lifestyle, including dietary modifications, detoxification. The very first week that someone's on this study, and this was a 12-month study, I had them make a list of all the things they could not have. You could no longer have anything that was an excitotoxin. So caffeine in any form, gone. MSG. Now, they didn't think that MSG was anything other than, let's say, some soy sauce. No, it's in a lot of the vegan analog dishes. Look for texturized soy protein. Unless it states on the label no MSG, then there's a high probability it contains MSG. So a lot of vegans have been getting MSG without knowing it. It can also be listed as flavor enhancers, and so it doesn't have to call itself MSG. Get rid of all artificial sodas, all the sweeteners, the aspartame, any form of artificial sweetener, get rid of it as well. Get rid of the food coloring agents and dyes and preservatives. Get rid of wheat and gluten, because I found that dairy frequently causes a cerebral allergy, meaning you're okay. You have yogurt, cheese, cottage cheese, skim milk, whole milk, and suddenly you're feeling depressed or fatigued or confused. That's frequently because you're having allergic reaction, a cerebral allergic reaction. So you get rid of it. You get your candida under control, the yeast that grows throughout our body, mainly in our intestine, because it goes into the bloodstream and it goes to the brain, and that can cause brain fog and depression. And once that's done, suddenly you see people coming in, and first thing we do is we always say, how did this week go? Yeah, they were keeping a food diary. Tell us what you experienced. And you have people saying, I'm starting to see this fog lift. My moods are actually starting to feel good, and that's concerning me because I'm so used to feeling depressed. I'm so used to complaining and feeling apathetic and negative, and I don't feel that way. Well, at the end of the study, we had 87% of the participants that completed the protocol no longer said that they were depressed. Now, I never tell a person not to take their meds or go off their medical treatment, but their doctors, their psychologists, were finding that they had radically changed, all because of lifestyle modification. So I'm glad they did this study. I'm glad that mainstream science is showing this to be the case. And by the way, you might also want to read retired neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock, B-L-A-Y-L-O-C-K. He wrote a book called Excitotoxins, The Taste That Kills, and the free glutamic foods, aspartame and other excitotoxins that contribute to chronic inflammation in the brain. And also I found that alcohol is one of the worst of the excitotoxins you can take into the body. It just massively kills brain cells. Massive. And that can lead to multiple sclerosis, it can lead to Parkinson, it can lead to all kinds of conditions. Sooner or later, you will meet the consequence to the earlier lifestyle choices. Finally, 5 diseases proven to respond better to cannabis than prescription drugs. And this is from a Dr. David Berman from Prevent Disease. And here's what he said. Cancer, cannabinoids, the active component of marijuana, inhibit tumor growth and can kill cancer cells. THC, the principal psychoactive constituent of cannabinoids of the cannabis plant, target the cannabinoid receptor similar in function to endocannabinoids, which are cannabinoids that are naturally produced in the body and activate these receptors. And now they're finding it can turn on or off a switch to the gene responsible for metastasis in an aggressive form of cancer. And he goes on to talk about a Spanish team headed by Dr. Manuel Guzman wanted to see whether they could prevent a form of cancer, glioblastoma, from growing by cutting off its blood supply. And glioblastoma, by the way, is one of the most difficult cancers to treat. It seldom responds to any medical intervention. And so genes associated with blood vessel growth in tumors through the production of a chemical called vascular endothelial growth factor have their activity reduced when exposed to cannabinoids. And the cannabinoids halt the vascular endothelial growth factor by producing ceramide, and ceramide controls cell death. So they were able to kill the cancer, stop it from growing, and produce what is called programmed cell death. It also worked in leukemia. It worked in lymphoma cell lines, thereby destroying the cancer cell by leaving the other cells unharmed. And an article published in the Journal of National Cancer Institute showed that the THC slowed the growth of lung cancer, breast cancer, and virus-induced leukemia in laboratory animals. So that was one. Second is fibromyalgia. And the results of 1,300 people in a study of the National Pain Foundation also found that there was statistically significant 62% had very effective treatment of their condition and pain. Then there is epilepsy. By far most common approach to treating epilepsy is the prescription of anti-epileptic drugs. But these are very, very toxic drugs. But here, this worked better, the cannabinoids. And several articles were published on this. Then multiple sclerosis. So if you know anyone out there who has multiple sclerosis, there's a way of having it treated more successfully with cannabinoids than others, and this was published in the Journal of Neurology. And finally, ADHD and ADD. So they found that this also helped them as well. So that's the latest from there. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. Want to let you know that I'll be in a few moments dealing with when water is a commodity instead of a human right. Shocking facts about America's militarized police forces. And by the way, on my website this morning, I was reading it and I saw that some people were just attacking the police verbally. And I challenged them. I said, you have no right to accuse every police officer in the United States of being as the ones you are seeing in these attacks. And hence, don't become a victim of the overly generalized statement. So I know that there are many police officers and their families who listen to this program. And one of the reasons they do is because they appreciate the objectivity. When something is wrong, you call it out. When you have a problem, you look at it, diagnose it, and offer solutions. And I believe that one of the ways that we can help this problem, a police brutality and militarization of the police, is by having those police officers who are in the police force and see this mindset and have them challenge it. And I think that is one of the ways that we will be helped. One of the ways. I'll give you other ideas when I do the commentary. We have a lot to go. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Well, I'm concerned about water. I'm concerned about the people of Detroit. But not just Detroit, but communities all across America now. There's one man who's in jail because he built a cistern beside his house to collect the rainwater. Weren't allowed to do that. Some ordinance said you couldn't do it. As a result, according to Pete Dolek, they're shutting off the water to over 150,000 people in Detroit, and that's just the beginning. The proposed privatization of the water system and the diversion of the system's revenue to banks are possible because the most basic human requirement, water, is becoming nothing more than a commodity. Now, the potential sale of the Detroit Water and Sewage Department is one more development of the idea that water, as with any commodity, exists to produce private profit rather than to be a public necessity. And if corporate plunder is to be the guiding principle, then those seen as most easy to push around will be expected to shoulder the burden. Thus, we have all these people with their water shut off, and no one cares. How do they get the water to bathe, to drink, to cook? People don't care. You didn't pay your water bill? We turned it off. On the other hand, no large corporations that are behind in their water payment bills have had it turned off. The water, Detroit Water and Sewage Department began its shutoff policy in March, and their goal was to shut off 3,000 people's water per week, every week. And some of the people owed as little as $150. And that is only 2 months of an average bill. Detroit water rates have more than doubled during the past decade. And that's substantial. Yet people's income have not. And in fact, it was only in July, months after residential water shutoffs began, did the water department announce it would send warning notices to delinquent businesses. There was no report that any business had its water turned off. About half the city's overdue water payments are owed by commercial and industrial customers. 40 offenders, according to the department, have past dues ranging from $35,000 to $400,000. And one golf course is said to owe hundreds of thousands of dollars, but they weren't closed down, turned off. The same week that the residential water shutoffs began, Detroit emergency manager Kevin Orr put the water department up for sale. The department takes in $1 billion in revenue per year, according to the Wall Street Journal, and collects more than that in revenue. And the system, so it's very profitable. The system would potentially be a valuable asset for one of the multinational corporations that have taken over privatized water systems around the world, mostly to the regret of local governments and ratepayers. Why? I'm against all these privatization moves because when I look at every single one, it's always to the detriment of the community and the citizens living there. Always. If emergency manager Orr succeeds in selling off Detroit's water system, he will be bucking the trend. Why? Because dozens of cities in France and Germany have reversed earlier privatization and are taking back their water systems after finding that higher prices and reduced services had been the norm post-privatization. French private water prices are 31% higher than in public water services. Five Pennsylvania towns that privatized their water saw their rates more than triple, three times higher on average. That rate differential shouldn't come as a surprise. A government doesn't need to generate a profit like a corporation. A water company, like any other capitalist enterprise, is expected to generate large profits for its investors and giant payouts to its executives, and thus must extract more money out of its property. If the water system is privatized, Detroit city budget would receive a one-time boost, but forgo future revenues and lose control of a public good built up with public money. Nor is there any guarantee that it would be sold at market value. A utility undervalued would produce quicker profits for any water company that got its hands on it, and every incentive is for it to be bought at as low a price as possible. Banks, however, have already extracted huge profits from Detroit's infrastructure. The water department is believed to have paid bank penalties of $537 million to escape its disastrous interest rate debts, default swaps. Instead of simply selling plain vanilla bonds, paying bondholders a set amount on a set schedule, Detroit, like many municipal governments, became entangled in various complicated financial derivatives layered on top of its bonds. Investment banks sold local government interest rate swaps as a form of insurance, as a hedge against rising interest rates. But if interest rates went down, which they did, then the governments would be on the hook for large sums of money. That rates would fall was predictable. Central banks cut interest rates as a matter of routine during recessions. Thanks to financial engineering, falsely sold as insurance, the Financial Times reports that it cost Detroit $2.7 billion to pay back $1.4 billion in borrowing. That includes $502 million in interest payments and $770 million as the cost of derivatives. That's Wall Street. The $537 million the Detroit Water Department handed to banks to escape continued extra payments to cover the swaps is more than four times the entire past due water bill, residential and commercial, at the start of the water shutoffs in March. Yet there appears to be no effort to recoup any of that penalty money or to investigate if there was any illegality in the deals. So, that's where we stand. It is my belief that water should never be turned off, that it should be in the public commons, and therefore should never be privatized. What are your thoughts on this? Give us a call. Before you do that, at 888-874-4888, I want to share just one more interesting thing about the militarization of our police. I've been talking about this for some time, as any of you listening know. And I've said many times, we are militarizing our police. There's going to be a danger to this. But no one paid attention because nobody was breaking in anyone's doors in Greenwich, Connecticut. There were no SWAT teams sent down to Wall Street. People in the theater district, as they came out of Broadway shows, were not being stopped and searched. So, people didn't think that it existed. Now you see, it does and has, and it's going to get a lot worse. The war on terror has come home, and it's wreaking havoc on innocent Americans' lives. The culprit is the militarization of the police, and according to Alec Kane, the weapons used in the war on terror that destroyed Afghanistan and Iraq have made their way to local law enforcement. And while police forces across the country began a process of militarization complete with SWAT teams and flashbang grenades when President Reagan intensified the war on drugs, the post-9/11 war on terror has added fuel to the fire. Through laws and regulations like a provision in defense budgets that authorized the Pentagon to transfer surplus military gear to police forces, local law enforcement are using weapons found on the battlefields of Southeast Asia and the Middle East. A recent New York Times article by Matt Apuzzo reported that in the Obama era, quote, police departments have received tens of thousands of machine guns, nearly 200,000 ammunition magazines, thousands of pieces of camouflage and night vision equipment, and hundreds of silencers, armored cars, and aircraft. The result is that police agencies around the nation possess military-grade equipment, turning officers who are supposed to fight crime and protect communities into what look like invading forces from an army. And military-style police raids are increased in recent years. One count saying 80,000 SWAT raids last year. 80,000. In June, the American Civil Liberties Union brought more attention to police militarization when it issued a comprehensive 100-page report called War Comes Home, The Excessive Militarization of American Policing. Based on public records requests, more than 260 law enforcement agencies in 26 states, quote, American policing has become excessively militarized through the use of weapons and tactics designed for the battlefield, unfairly impacting people of color and undermining individual liberties, and has been allowed to happen in the absence of a meaningful public discussion. Everyone's impacted. Children, the use of SWAT teams are unnecessary. in 90% of all SWAT teams are to serve a summons or to do a search where there is no crime that's been proven to have been committed. And why are we using our war on terror to fuel a local military in the form of police? The average American is not engaged in any war. Oh, you mean drugs? Yeah, well, we should have legalized that to stop all this nonsense. You have a lot of private companies engaged in all this, from the Black Hawk Industries and Lockheed Martin. They're the ones who, at the end of the day, through the Department of Homeland Security grants, make all the money to keep all this equipment and all this training of all these SWAT teams in the Urban Shield, a major arms expo that has attracted increasing attention from activists. So police agencies, military contractors, SWAT, they all converge on Urban Shield, which was held in California last year, to see what kind of gadgets and toys they can buy. So just remember, the broader militarization and police militarization go hand in hand. So now you have a war on terror, then a war on drugs, and a war on dissent, a war on freedom of speech. That's what we're dealing with now. And we have to remember that, because otherwise we will end up a victim of all that. I'm Gary Knoll. Those are some thoughts I'd like to hear from you now in our talkback segment, 888-874-4888. Let's take our final break and come right back. Please stay with us.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, baby, scarlet billows start to spread.
Fancy gloves, though. We're going towards the last part of our program today. I want to mention before we go to the calls that Colgate toothpaste, according to Jody Gummall of Alternet, has got a chemical in it, and that chemical is linked to cancer. Quote, it may be time to check out your toothpaste, according to a new Bloomberg report, which has revealed that the controversial chemical triclosan, found in antibacterial soaps, is also used as an ingredient to fight gum disease in the top-selling product Colgate Total. In recent times, triclosan safety has been contentious in light of a number of studies that indicate the drug is a potential hormone disruptor and linked to cancer cell growth. And now an investigative Bloomberg report is questioning the previously concealed but recently released FDA 35-page review process that led to the toothpaste approval in 1997. Quote, a closer look at that application process reveals that some of the scientific findings Colgate put forward to establish triclosan's safety in toothpaste weren't black and white and weren't until this year available to the public. Among the findings were studies showing that tadpoles exposed to a small amount of triclosan, which is found in a blob of toothpaste, grew into small frogs with malformed legs, as well as malformation in mice and rats. What's more, most of the evidence relied upon in approving the drug in Colgate Total in 1997 came from company-backed research. Well, so if you're using Colgate's Total toothpaste, just be aware. A caveat emptor, heads up. Sonia from Manhattan, your turn.
Yes. Hi, how are you, Gary?
Good, thank you.
So I wanted to talk, really comment on the story and what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri. I have been kind of following this event kind of closely, reading a lot of the news reports. I'm in Manhattan, so I'm not there. But according to witnesses, the police allowed some outside agitators with guns to come in and loot the community, and meanwhile the police were blocking either end of the town, and that it seemed to him that they were using these people to do the looting and then come in and declare martial law. after using that as a incident that required them to then come and control the community. When actually the people and the protesters weren't involved with the looting, just some armed groups. Had you heard anything about that?
I have heard it, but I have no way of verifying it at this time. But keep in mind that the FBI and other agencies have a long and sordid history of setting up groups, of infiltration, and of trying to inspire people to commit crimes so they can come in and stop the crime or apprehend them to take credit for it. That's what we saw, for example, in all those so-called terrorist attacks stop. No, they didn't stop any of these terrorist attacks. They had set up people in order to commit a terrorist act, but these people wouldn't have committed a terrorist act. These were not terrorists. And so we could very easily have this happen. Can I prove it at this point? No. But in time, we'll find out. What we have seen is that and we should keep our focus that the majority of the people involved in the peaceful demonstration were there to give solidarity to the idea that this police brutality has gone on too long, and that how long do you think it would have taken for a demonstration if this would have been a successful white businessman or woman who had been shot and killed under similar circumstances? Then you would have seen an entirely different reaction. So there is always this idea that when a group of blacks get together to protest some injustice, that it's the black getting together that are the problem, not what they're protesting. And that's part of our racist profile in the United States. Your thoughts?
Well, I tend to agree. It seems that, but the trend, I mean, yes, the marginalization of people of color in general, especially, but I just wonder why they would, why they're coming out in force now against people who basically aren't doing anything. They're just trying to live their lives. Why are they imposing?
Sonia, did they not come out in force against Occupy, a group of principally young people, totally unarmed, no terrorist intention, simply trying to address some of the problems with the banking system and the inequality in our society? Did they not taser them, beat them? Did the Homeland Security not even have planned for snipers to be on buildings in Houston targeting leaders? Did they not infiltrate every single Occupy group in the United States? Every single Occupy meeting in the United States had infiltration, as it turns out, from WikiLeaks that showed us that they had been infiltrated. What threat did they represent?
Right, they didn't represent much of a threat, that's for sure. Yeah.
So it wasn't the color that mattered, and it wasn't the threat that counted. It was the fact that this is the normal way to adapt people to any form of social protest. No matter what your protest, who you are, where you're coming from, you will be met with strong militarized force you cannot overcome, and hence understand you better not protest. So I believe that in part the overreaction is intended to send a chilling message that if you have a problem, stay in your communities and communicate privately. Do not make anything public, no matter how egregious the action of a given or group of individuals may be against you. In effect, this is Orwell's prediction, where people no longer protest because they're afraid of the consequences.
Can we take them to court?
You can't take them to court for what they've done, because what they're doing is in compliance with the executive orders that have been signed over the years, including the National Defense Authorization Act. So at any given time, any meeting, any demonstration for any cause, any reason against any person or part of the government is now considered a terrorist threat to the United States. And you will have the cloned idiots who work in these governmental agencies who will automatically respond as if you, the public, in protest, are no longer a citizen because you're not compliant. Instead, you represent a threat, and therefore they will have no moral compunction but to infiltrate, to be provocateurs, to get visual scans, retinal scans, data on anyone who's led it, read the emails, and then respond with the 80,000 last year forced entries, the no-knock entries, because now SWATs don't know how to knock on a door. They simply break down the door and throw a grenade in. You could be having a prayer service. These are robots. These are not people with conscious thinking. They have allowed themselves to be acclimated, much like in a war zone. And if we remember, all these people first go through an indoctrination. You just don't become a police officer. Now, how you are taught and what you are taught and the way you are conditioned to respond will determine the outcome. If you're taught that these are not enemy combatants but citizens, if you're taught that these people have a right under the Constitution to protest, then you will be measured in your response. If you're otherwise taught, as they are now, a hyper-masculine on steroids, a concept of the strong, hard takedown, taser them first, shoot them first, beat them first, mace them first, then if you're taught that over and over again, then you're no different in many regards than a combat person in Iraq or Afghanistan or Vietnam who will shoot someone first and then have a conversations with their conscience later. Why do you think so many of the people coming back who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder? The post-traumatic stress disorder is frequently, and I've talked with hundreds of vets about this, is because of what they viewed or what they saw or what they had to tolerate in a battle zone that was wrong. The killing of innocent people, the murder of people, the rape of people. When you see this, you experience that this goes against your moral fiber. This goes in direct opposition to your actual authentic spiritual nature. And as a result, how do you deal with that? Now you're out of that environment and you come home and you haven't resolved anything. And so it stays with you. That dialogue, those images don't go away. Why do you think we don't talk about this? All we talk about is how to drug someone who's got post-traumatic stress disorder and get them hospitalization. We don't talk about what is the nature of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
It's not merely they felt insecure about their next step. They could be killed. Yes, that is possible. But it's frequently about what they personally did or others did in the system that conditioned them. We don't have a boot camp for reconditioning people to come back into civilian life, do we?
No.
But when they go into the armed forces, their hair is cut, they're told to get up, they're all told to comply, to obey, because there's a chain of command, they must honor it, no matter what they're told, they must do it. So we've taken away much of their conditioned, normal conditioned response from a humane spiritual level, and instead we put a militaristic response to everything. When they come back, they still have that response. A lot of them get into fights. A lot of them get into drugs. A lot of them get into alcohol. A lot of them end up abusing their family members. And we're not talking about it. We're not having an authentic conversation on the militarization of any person. Now we're seeing the militarization of the police. Well, imagine this. Imagine living in Iraq and Afghanistan for the last 15 years or 12 years, and all you've seen is the militarization in your daily lives. Now you get a little tiny 1% of 1/100th of 1% of what the people in an operational theater have had to go through. How does it feel?
Well, I can't imagine what it must be like in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And try Gaza as well.
Yeah, Gaza, God help us. I mean, that's just so disgusting.
It is. Sonia, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. But we're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow.